Hello and welcome. You're listening to Tales of the Sea. This is Mark Winkworth. It might have been predicted that my guest today would become enchanted with the sea. As a young boy, while spending summers on an island off the idyllic coast of Maine, Trevor Corson was surrounded by beautiful, clean, cold waters, the perfect habitat for oysters, shrimp, mussels, scallops, fish, and of course, the famous Maine lobsters. Today, he's the author of two highly acclaimed books, including The Story of Sushi, and his first book, which is a narrative nonfiction, but reads like a novel, really, which we'll talk about today, The Secret Life of Lobsters, a book that was named the best nature book of the year on its release. Trevor is an accomplished journalist. His numerous articles and essays cover subjects as diverse as science, medicine, food, race, economics, international politics, and military strategy and history. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, the Atlantic Monthly, and numerous other publications. Trevor's great-grandfather was an early member of the Champlain Society, founded in the year 1880 by a group of students at Harvard University. The society was named for the French explorer and navigator Samuel de Champlain. The students would spend summers on Mount Desert Island, where they believed in learning from nature, in the health benefits of outdoor pursuits, and in science education. Each member of the group would do some work in natural history or science during their stays on the island. Trevor Corson's grandfather carried on the traditions of the Champlain Society, spending summers amid the spectacular scenery of Mount Desert Island. Trevor's grandparents continued visiting the area and decided to buy a house on Little Cranberry Island, located just off the coast of Mount Desert Island. It was on this island, where the year-round population consisted mostly of fishermen, that a young Trevor Corson would grow increasingly infatuated with the fishing culture, specifically lobstering. So much so that he once shared his dream with his parents to forego the expected educational path for a young man at that time, to become a lobsterman. What age were you when you actually said to your folks, "Mom and Dad, it's you know, I got something to share with you. I want to be a lobsterman. This whole school thing is not making it for me."
Yeah, I mean, I think that I started to already get obsessed with the lobsterman when I was a small boy. But I think it was probably that like high school period where it starts to get really intense with applying for college and all that stuff. And I was like, oh God, there's got to be something else I could do. And I had the idea that I would go work on a lobster fishing boat in the summers. And that did not seem to my parents to be at all conducive to getting into college. And in addition, I realized later that there really weren't like summer lobstering jobs so much. The big season, it's more of a year-round fishery in many ways. At least the big season was in the fall. So my whole plan didn't make any sense. And my parents obviously understood that and discouraged me. But it was one of those things where like you want to rebel against your parents in the end, right? To really
sure
get your independence. And so I didn't let go of it, even though I gave up on it, you know, right then in high school. I didn't let go of it.
I like that. So talk a little bit about your education from that point on, from high school on, and what your focus of study was.
Well, yeah, I mean, even though I end up writing a book about the Maine coast, I can't claim any, you know, identification properly with the Maine coast. I'm not from Maine. I had a very fancy, privileged urban upbringing in the Washington, D.C. area. I went to fancy schools, and that's why the whole, you know, college application thing was there was so much pressure on it in that social milieu. There always is. And I had a fairly actually unconventional path after that. I had gotten a scholarship when I was 15 or 16 in high school to go to Japan for a summer. But so that started an interest in East Asia, the Japan and China trips. And so when I eventually did come back and go to college, and I went to a very fancy school, I went to Princeton, got more scholarships and grants to go back to Japan and study the Japanese culture by just living there and talking to people and taking lots of notes. And I was supposed to be doing academic research, but I kind of ended up just writing stories about the people I met and what their lives were like. That was what interested me the most. And at some point I realized, wait a minute, this isn't really academic. I don't really want to go write, a PhD that nobody's going to read. I'd like to just get to know people and learn about their lives and then write stories about them that anyone could read and be interested in. So I think I didn't realize it then, but like later that kind of directed me towards journalism and nonfiction writing. And that is how I eventually got around to that path.
So at some point you decide to return to Little Cranberry.
Yeah. So I was on this academic path realizing that I didn't want to be an academic. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I need a plan B. What am I going to do? So having spent childhood summers on Little Cranberry Island in Maine and been, obsessed with lobstermen and their boats and having wanted to do that, I finally came back around to it. And I thought, I'll go move there year round. I'll get a job on a lobster fishing boat. Finally, I'll do it. My childhood dream or my teenage dream, whatever. And then in the winters, when there's some time off, when the weather's really bad, I'll sit by the wood stove in my island cabin and write the great American novel. that was my plan. And I wrote some really terrible stuff that I ended up throwing into the wood stove and burning, basically.
So you go back. You certainly were connected, and folks knew you, as you say. Was it tough to find work as a sternman on a lobster boat?
Yes and no. The thing is that they need workers. They need people willing to do it. It's not an easy job, and especially in the colder months, it's not pleasant. And it also, if you have any tendency to seasickness or anything like that, you will not survive. So they actually do need people willing to do it, but there's a healthy degree of skepticism among the boat captains about whether you will actually be able to do it. So right. I wanted to get a job guaranteed and move to this island and fulfill this new plan I had, but I couldn't get a firm commitment from any fisherman to take me on because I was some random city kid. They knew who I was, but it's not like I had worked on boats before. So, of course, they were completely unwilling to make any promises. Basically, the best I got was, well, here, come on over and try it out. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I'm like rearranging my whole life, moving to this tiny island year round with 70 people on it in the winter. I want to make sure that I have an income. And I had to just go on faith. There was one lobsterman from one of the main old lobster fishing families there. And he knew, my grandparents. And so I was a known quantity to him, just that I was a person who was reliable. But of course, he didn't know whether I'd be able to handle the job. And so I just showed up and started, basically working. And like the first day on the boat was one of the most difficult days of my life. I was just completely wiped out after. But he told me to come back the next day. Later, he revealed to me that I think that I had been one of the better first timers on his boat that he had run across. So he was willing to keep me on.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. And I just loved it. I loved it so much. The captain I worked with took a couple months off in the winter to repair his gear and stuff. So I would do some of the work with him during the winter on land, but we would fish right through Christmas.
So let's talk about your first book, journalistic nonfiction, I think would be the correct title. The Secret Life of Lobsters. Now, it's not something that a lot of people think about. Not a whole lot of people that I know would think about the life of a lobster, let alone community or community, how they communicate and so on. So where did the inspiration come from, and how did this book come to life?
Yeah, it was a long and winding path, and I didn't either think about the life of lobsters at all. I was more interested in the fishermen and their life and work and everything. And I thought I could write something about that, but I didn't know what exactly. It was actually just from working on the boat for so long every day that I learned what the fishermen's concerns were, and I learned what they were paying attention to, for starters. I had studied some science in college, some environmental and animal behavior classes and stuff. I started to develop a profound respect for the lobstermen's observational skills and analytic skills in terms of the resource, the environment, and the animals that they were fishing, mm-hmm. which is a weird thing to say in one sense, because you don't really expect, you know, basically they make their living off as many dead lobsters as possible. You don't really expect them to be open to that kind of thinking. But actually, it's the other way around. They had to be, because they had to understand the animals well enough to be able to catch it. They actually were very observant. And I thought, you know, almost none of them even had a college education, but they were like scientists in my view. After a while, I realized they took lots of notes and little notebooks, and they observed things, and they exchanged observations with each other about what they were seeing. And I think it's a unique form of fishing, because you don't, unlike a big net that just catches everything and all the fish die, mm-hmm. with lobsters, they use traps, and pretty much everything that comes up in the trap survives the experience, and you can either keep it or throw it back over. And so the small lobsters, the big lobsters, the ones they didn't keep, they would just throw back over, and those lobsters would be fine and sink back to the bottom and keep on doing their thing. And the traps were in a way like little observation capsules of what was on the bottom of the ocean. They developed a huge amount of anecdotal information. And then the second thing that happened was actually that because I was working on the lobster boats, when we were out in the water, we would actually run across scientists who were studying the lobster population in the water. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so I didn't know what was going on at all. And this just one day we were out in the boat and there was some scuba divers. I thought maybe they were diving for scallops or something. But my captain drove the boat over and started chatting with them. And it turned out he knew these people. They were actually researchers from the University of Maine. They were going down in scuba gear in shallow water to count lobsters, measure them and stuff. And they were talking to each other, the fishermen and the scientists. That was quite interesting to me. And I started to talk to the scientists eventually also. So that was kind of how I gradually became aware that there was this whole scientist story going on.
Your plan at some point was to pick up some writing chops, just in terms of how am I going to attack this thing when I really sit down to put it together. So that led to yet another piece of your interesting and a varied career, which was a stint in journalism, correct?
Yeah. After a couple of years sitting by the wood stove and writing garbage, I realized that, oh, you know, maybe I need to actually learn something about how to be a professional writer. So with somewhat heavy heart, I realized after two and a half, three years, I had to leave the island. I had to go back to the city to learn journalism. I managed to wangle an internship in Boston at the Atlantic Monthly magazine, which at that time was located there. Several of the great magazine editors in recent American history who worked there, William Whitworth and Cullen Murphy. And it was in a conversation with Cullen Murphy about this lobster thing. I said, look, I'm really interested in this whole lobstering story. And there's so many aspects to it. And I would kind of give him proposal notes, you know, mm-hmm. and he'd be like, no, I don't think so. No. Finally, I was like trying to tell him about the science stuff. I thought, oh, wait, I have to include the science, the lobster science stuff that I had been observing. And as soon as he saw that, he was like, that's it. That's the story. And, you know, I really have to credit him, like a good magazine editor who really has an instinct for what story is going to work for what topic and for what audience. And so I have to credit him for turning me onto the focus about the science, mm-hmm. particularly that could be the core of the story about the lobster fishery in Maine. And from there, I ran with it. I spent more time talking with the scientist I had met, talking with fishermen about the lobster science situation. I started to learn more about the larger debate that was going on. And it turned out there was a big, like, huge fisheries management / environmental science ecology fight going on in relation to how to handle the lobster fishery. And once I kind of became aware of that larger dynamic, then, okay, this is a magazine story. I can write this. And then also having done that kind of ethnographic style research by working on the fishing boats, that's where that piece came in. It ended up being a very large, big article in the Atlantic Monthly.
Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned to me at one point that it was a good thing that you didn't have a big, large science background.
I mean, I think I had taken just enough kind of science, basic science courses in college that I had enough awareness that I could move forward. But at the same mm-hmm. time, I think you're right. In a way, it was good that I wasn't a scientist myself mm-hmm. because I came to it all with a fresh eye. I didn't have any prejudices about different types of scientific approach or how, what kind of scientific conclusion or theory would be correct over another. And I didn't know enough about any of the science to have firm views about any of it. So I had to just like go to lots of different scientists in different areas of this controversy and just ask stupid questions to kind of get them to explain to me what their point of view was. And so I spent a lot of time sitting down and interviewing the ecologists in Maine at the University of Maine who were in the water a lot. I went out on research ships with them. I watched them do submersible dives and scuba dives and send down underwater robots. And then I also went to the fisheries management science offices, particularly in Woods Hole in Massachusetts, where the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Atlantic States, they had this like state council management arrangement and talked to those scientists and got their perspective. I was kind of a babe in the woods in some ways on this, and I had to really educate myself. I probably saw the kind of scientific-ish observations of the lobstermen that a normal journalist would not see. So I had three different perspectives. I was getting the perspective of the ecologists, I was getting the perspective of the fisheries management scientists, and I was also getting the perspective of the fishermen. Now, normally, you would think that the industry view would be prejudiced because the industry people just want to make money. That's not untrue. However, because of what I was saying before about the way lobster traps work and that fishermen on lobster boats were able to see their resource in a way that, other kinds of fishermen don't necessarily.
Right.
They actually had a perspective that I had to take into account. And so I had to make a judgment call at some point based on these three different kind of sources of information that I had available to me. And it was very challenging. I really had to do a lot of research. I spent hours and hours in the zoology library at Harvard reading through dozens of scientific reports and papers and historical documents related to this whole management controversy and everything. Interviewed lots of people, interviewed anthropologists, read their books. There's an amazing anthropologist, James Acheson, who'd written about the Maine lobster fishery. Incredibly valuable to get that perspective. So that, again, was like ethnography, the anthropology point of view. Right. It was actually frightening because I had to a little bit go out on a limb, but the evidence that I had accumulated made me critical of the fisheries management science, and that was backed up by the work of the ecologists. So there was a different kind of science that was coming, using different methods and coming to different conclusions. So I could see, and anyone who's studied the history of science knows this about science, that there's different approaches, different cultures, different assumptions that can result in different scientific conclusions. And trying to, evaluate that is a matter of weighing evidence over time. And so the article I ended up writing was fairly critical of the fisheries management science. I think that's also, though, what made it an interesting story.
The debates were going on then, and they're still continuing today. about proper management of the resource.
Yeah, the management folks were not happy with what I had written, but I stuck by it. I stuck by my reporting. And at that point, there was interest in having a book version developed of the article. So I started working on the book. And so that was more and more research to fill in a lot of stuff. And I essentially came still to the same conclusions in the book as I had in the article. The controversy had its own dynamics, so I don't know to what extent my writing impacted it, but it certainly brought it to public attention. But in the end, an outside panel of experts was convened to try to assess the controversy and the state of the science and what should be done. Mm. So they tried to get people who had, you know, really strong backgrounds in these different fields and approaches of science, but who weren't themselves involved in the lobster fishery management.
Right.
So they would be more objective. They called it a blue ribbon panel of experts. And so that panel did this similar to what I had done and reviewed all the science, but they were actual, you know, scientist experts. They essentially came to a similar conclusion as I had. Mm-hmm. They basically said that the fisheries science was lacking enough of the ecological data of the type that the other scientists, the ecologists, were collecting, and that the and that the fishermen were actually a valuable part of this process. And so what happened is that the fisheries management science was expanded after that to include not just taking fishermen at their word, but sending observers out on the boats to document what the fishermen were seeing. You know, scientifically trained observers, so actual scientists. And they were able to basically confirm what the fishermen had been observing anecdotally. So I think that was kind of the key thing. And that data, and then a bunch of other kinds of ecological data collection that I also describe in the book, which, all of which is very fun. Like, science is cool. They came up with all these crazy methods of observing lobsters in the wild. I mean, that whole story of the book is just so funny. You know, like using super glue and duct tape to put like transponders on lobsters so you could track where the big females with eggs were going, and then like lab studies to observe their sex life and how do they make eggs and all this stuff, and then where do the baby lobsters land, and then trying to count them. And it's hilarious and fascinating and wonderful.
We'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the critters themselves
then. Yeah.
And what you personally found as the most interesting, surprising, eye-opening, jaw-dropping about these critters that, frankly, there's so many in the book that I'd love to hear a few of your favorite discoveries.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually an incredibly fun book to research and write because the lobsters turned out to be just such hilarious characters. I mean, I had no idea. It's just amazing. Lobsters are very old, very primitive creatures. They go back to the age of the dinosaurs, but they don't have complex nervous systems. They live in these communities, little neighborhoods, and they kind of get to know each other, and they establish these sort of social hierarchies in their neighborhood. They like to live under rocks where they're safe. Strong, big lobsters outcompete, you know, the smaller ones for the best houses. And then the alpha, you know, this kind of an alpha male who dominates each neighborhood and goes around and kind of roughs up the, you know, it's like a sort of a mafia situation, sort of roughs
the bullies,
up everyone else every day to remind them who's in charge. Yeah. But the funny thing is that these alpha males, they think they're all big and tough and running the show, but what happens next is hilarious. The females in the neighborhood, they all then identify who the alpha male is because he comes and reminds them. And just a quick interlude here. The way that lobsters communicate with each other is literally by pissing in each other's faces. I didn't realize this, but they have these little nozzles on their cheeks. Next time, if you're observing a lobster up close, you can look and see. And they have a urine bladder in their head, you know, where we have a brain, or where we should have a brain. They have a urine bladder. There's days when I feel that way about myself. Like, what happened? My brain did. But they squirt these chemical signals to each other out of these nozzles on their cheeks. And they lace this this urine with chemical signals. And then they have their little antennae and they detect the signal being sent by the other lobster through this squirt jet of urine. So in combat, the alpha males are squirting these like dominance, you know, chemicals. The females in the neighborhood, they detect lobsters have pretty bad eyesight. So they do a lot of, because it's dark down there, most of this happens by chemical signaling.
Right.
And the females then, they go and they start to pay visits on the alpha male and when he gets back to his house. What they do is they create this kind of sisterhood, and then they piss out of the front of their head into his house and they stick a different chemical in their pee, and it's like a drug. And it drugs him into submission. And so he suddenly becomes, usually he's very belligerent, and they kind of drug him into submission, and suddenly he becomes very romantic and protective. And then one female after another, they hook up with the alpha male. It's right. called it's not a one night stand. It's about 2 weeks. They hook up, they shack up together for about 2 weeks, and it's called serial monogamy. Right. So during those 2 weeks, they're monogamous. And the first female goes in, and the arrangement is very great because the female she takes her clothes off during this time, which is right. when they mate, by which I mean she sheds her shell, is how lobsters grow. So she's right. very vulnerable during that process. So the arrangement is that she sheds her shell when she's very soft. This alpha male, who's the toughest guy in the neighborhood, protects her. And in exchange, she's allowed to mate with her. And then she, after her new shell hardens up, then she moves out. And then the next female in the neighborhood is waiting at the door. And then she takes her turn. And so they all have their way with this alpha male. And it good work if you can get it. But it's I'm sure it's exhausting for him. And then he'll shed his shell eventually later. And at that point, you know, if there's any other aspiring alpha males in the neighborhood, he'll be lucky if they don't come in and gobble him up and take his place.
Which
so
yeah.
it's risky. It's risky business also.
It's a high risk business.
Yeah.
High risk business. And the sisterhood, they take off, but they hang on to their eggs and they decide when they're going to lay their eggs. And they're already carrying the sperm on board.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, they have this like little fanny pack. The sperm doesn't go all the way in and fertilize any eggs right away. Mm-hmm. They can mm-hmm. use it at their own convenience if they want to. They have a little fanny pack thing on the outside of their shell, and the sperm from the male goes in there, and they just clamp it shut and keep it in there. And then right. later, when they're ready to release their eggs, they can open that up and fertilize the eggs as they release them. It's right. like a time right. capsule, sperm time right. capsule.
But they control. I mean, that's what I said. The females really control not only the courtship, but the laying of the eggs.
I think this is why the book resonated with so many people, because it's like the males think they're in charge and then they realize, right. oh, no, I'm not in charge at all.
Forget about that. I'm not in charge at all. But were those just curious, going back to practices that you observed when you were sternman on the lobster boat for those 2.5 years. What were the practices that we think about today, the V-notching of the females, and were all of those in place 20-some years ago?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other side of the story that I get into in the book, which is fascinating, which is that the lobstermen kind of came up with their own homegrown ways to conserve the resource, and they right. were actually quite effective. So they figured out, and this was a hard lesson they had learned. The lobster population had been wiped out from overfishing earlier, and so they realized they should not do that again. And they came up with these ways of protecting the female lobsters that had eggs on them. So basically, uh-huh. you mentioned V-notching. When a big female lobster comes up in the trap covered with eggs, if it's the first time she's been caught with eggs on, they just cut a little notch in the tail flipper to mark the lobster mm-hmm. and throw it back. And then the idea is that all the other fishermen just agree not to catch that lobster anymore. And it's illegal if you bring it in to, they eventually codified it, and it's illegal to actually catch and sell a V-notched lobster. Uh-huh. That way, their thinking was that they were creating this kind of protected population of breeder females that would just keep making eggs, and that would replenish the fishery. And I mean, it seems to have worked pretty well. The population has not been limited by reproductive capacity.
Mm-hmm. And that was something, as you say, the lobstermen came up with. It wasn't...
The details of it are an interesting story, which I go through in the book, how these different management techniques evolved. And there was a little bit of from different sides that contributed to them, sort of management and fishermen themselves. But I think the main point is that because the lobster fishery is a fishery where you can catch a lobster and throw it back and it'll be fine, which is different from most fisheries. You can't, if a fish comes up in a net, it probably dies. You can't. Right. And so if you get a big fish full of eggs, you can't save it and throw it back very easily. Mm. But with lobsters, you can. And so they realized it was actually in their interest to protect these egg-bearing lobsters and keep throwing them back. So they supported it. And this was a point of contention because, you know, fisheries managers have had plenty of experience with fishermen who lie about what they're doing. And that's also a true experience that they've had. So there's a lack of trust, and it was hard for them to believe that lobstermen would actually be choosing voluntarily to protect these egg bearing lobsters. But, you know, having worked on the boats, I absolutely saw that they did.
Right.
And that there were huge numbers of them in the water. I mean, they'd come up in the traps all the time, covered with eggs.
Are there things about the book that today still kind of delight you in terms of either someone's reaction to it or learnings that you've had or things that you've experienced in the years since?
Well, I mean, my favorite comment of all ever was when the book came out, and one of the lobstermen I knew, after he'd read it, he's like, "I learned more from your book than I did from 30 years of lobstering." And I thought that is the greatest compliment I could ever receive. The other thing that's changed a lot since 20 years ago is that there's more risk of the lobster fishery now becoming a victim of its own success. And what I mean is that because lobstermen have done such a good job of protecting the resource in so many ways and fishing it sustainably, and I really think they're an example for the world in that way, because they've been so successful, they've made a lot of money. And, you know, that's fine. But one of the effects has been that the boats have become bigger and more expensive, and more fishermen have taken out bigger and bigger loans for bigger boats and more equipment because they have the money to do so. And the banks, you know, want to lend to them because of that and everything. And again, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with that per se, as long as they continue to stick with their conservation techniques. The risk, though, is that if there is another natural downswing in the lobster population for reasons that may have to do with climate or oceanography or other things, the industry is now much more capitalized and indebted than it was before. Mm-hmm. So in the old days, you know, 20 years ago or 40 years ago, in the period of that I was writing about in the book, their equipment was less expensive and there was less of it, and the boats were smaller and not so pricey. And so you could weather a downturn. You know, you put money away for a rainy day and you weren't like highly leveraged as a fisherman financially. Right. But today, I think the risk is that there's a lot of young fishermen who are very financially leveraged with a lot of debt in their equipment. And if there's if the downswing starts to occur, then, you know, that's a financial problem for them. And how are they going to handle that? I think that's one risk that I see now.
Excellent point. An important point. I just want to thank you so much. We've covered a lot of ground. Of course, you know, I've encouraged everyone I know to read the book, and many have, and it's been a real eye-opening and a delight. So last question I have, you're under no obligation, but I love to ask folks if they have a favorite tale or book, poem or song or something that can share that really relates to the sea.
Yeah, well, there is a great book that I think I could never have written my book without. And I have a love-hate relationship with this book, but everyone should go read it after they read mine. And it's called Beautiful Swimmers by William Warner. It was published in 1977. And it's a book similar to mine, but not so much with science, but it's about the Chesapeake Bay crab fishery. And Warner, you know, he really created a genre there. He did similarly. He spent a lot of time out on boats in the Chesapeake Bay with the blue crab fishermen and wrote about their culture and how the fishing technology and everything worked. And it was just a beautiful book. It definitely was a major inspiration for me in figuring out how to write my book and that I could even do that, you know, that there was a precedent for that already. I feel like I owe a debt to Warner and his book. I say a love-hate relationship, though, because it was such a good book. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for that book. And wow. You know, I hate him to this day because in all of human history, there's only going to be one Pulitzer Prize for a book about crustaceans. And he got it 20 years before I could have a chance. So I'm a little jealous, but yeah. It's a great book. I recommend that one, too.
That goes on my list. Trevor, thanks again.
Well, yeah, it's been fun for me to revisit all this after so many years, and I want to thank you very much for having me on your show.
That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. I want to extend a special thanks to Trevor Corson for being so very generous of his time. And a reminder, you can find Trevor's books, both The Story of Sushi and The Secret Life of Lobsters, on Amazon, and I highly encourage you to seek them out. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend or two. And remember that you can find Tales of the Sea on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. This is Mark Wankworth. Thanks for listening.